Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel. And today, my guest is historian Jason Lustig. We'll be talking here at New Books in Jewish Studies and New Books in German Studies and New Books in History about his new book called A Time Together, Archives and the Control of Jewish Culture, published by Oxford University Press 2021. Thanks, Jason, for joining me here in Austin.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
So for our listeners here at New Books Network, Jason Lustig is a lecturer and Israel Institute teaching fellow at the Schusterman Center for Jewish Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, where he's also an affiliate of the History Department. This first book, A Time Together, is just out, published by Oxford in December 2021. And it traces the 20th century struggle over who might own Jewish history, especially after the Nazi looting of Jewish archives. I'm delighted to talk to a fellow podcaster. Dr. Lustig is also the host and creator of the wonderful Jewish History Matters podcast. He received his PhD at the UCLA Department of History and has also been a Harry Star Fellow in Judaica at Harvard's Center for Jewish Studies, and a Gerald Westheimer Early Career Fellow at the Leo Beck Institute. So thanks, Jason, so much for joining me to talk about your new book today.
Thank you so much.
So let's get right into the book, A Time to Gather, a book about archives and archival visions. Jason, could you tell us what it got you interested in the topic to begin with?
Yeah, so I have always been deeply interested in the relationship between history and memory and nationalism and politics, essentially about how history is put to use in the present in order to shape the future. And kind of at the center of all of these issues is how people have claimed history as their own. And so when I came towards this idea to write about archives and to write about the history of Jewish archives in the 20th century and what it all means, you know, those issues became very practical. It's not just about, you know, how you own history in a metaphorical sense, but in a very practical sense. You know, you physically hold this stuff and say, look, I have it. And so that was part of the way in which I came to it.
I'm really intrigued, Jason, in reading through your five chapters and in how you get into archives and their epistemology, the epistemes and sort of epistemic grounding of archives and archival visions. Could you talk a little bit about the big argument or one of your big arguments in the book about the totality of archives and the dream of having a complete archive?
Yeah. So when I think about the argument of the book and what I'm trying to say in the biggest terms, I think that when we look at the development of Jewish archival initiatives and activities over the course of the 20th century, there are a number of major themes that kind of tie together what is taking place and what is going on. I was struck very early by just how many archives Jews were creating in different places all over the world, essentially all at the same time. And what I was trying to indicate in the book is simultaneously this process of gathering together materials, as I call it, a time to gather. And I can say more about what that means, because it's actually a quote from one of the figures who's involved in this whole process. But it's this impulse to gather together everything. And this is a manifestation of a whole range of cultural, political issues in the early and mid 20th centuries, especially around the axis of the Holocaust, but also in other contexts as well. But at the same time, you know, as everybody is trying to create their own archives, it leads fundamentally to this tremendous conflict over who's going to have what, where it's going to be, what it's going to mean. And so when I look at this, the key theme that I see is that everybody is creating these archives. In the book, I focus on Germany, on the U.S., and on Israel and Palestine, in those three particular regions, but it also goes beyond it as well, that everybody is creating these archives kind of out of this shared impulse to preserve the past, but it's not neutral. It has a political relevance. It has a cultural relevance in their own time, because having all of this stuff is a signifier of their ability to shape the future. There's much more that I could say about it. I think that one of the other key arguments here has to do with the notion of totality, Stephen, that you mentioned, which is that I've identified a series of archives in Germany, in the U.S., and Israel-Palestine, the three main ones being the Gesamtarchiv der Deutschen Juden, the central German Jewish archive, which was in Berlin, founded in 1903, the Jewish Historical General Archives, which was in Jerusalem, founded initially in 1939, and then opened in officially in 1947, and then basically around the same time in 1947, you have the American Jewish Archives, which is in Cincinnati. And so all three of these archives represent this vision of total collecting, gathering everything. And this is tied in with specific issues in these three regions, but also about what is the future of Jewish life in the aftermath, particularly of the Holocaust, as you have this impulse to kind of bring together the kind of the forces of Jewish life as a whole. You have Jews being scattered, this kind of the nature of Jewish history, right, with dispersion in diaspora. And this is giving greater emphasis in the context of the Holocaust, displaced persons and so on and so forth. And just as people are trying to bring together the scattered remnants of the destroyed European Jewish communities in terms of people, but they're also doing it in terms of archives. And so when you look at some of these archival visions, it's really very much, especially in the post-Holocaust era, about what does it mean to reconstruct and to rebuild Jewish life. And so these archives, they're not just historical materials, they're also powerful metaphors for what's going on in terms of Jewish culture in a much broader sense.
Yeah, I like how you frame it in the book in light of what you call post-Holocaust restitution. And of course, I'm thinking here as a Polish historian as well about the looting and destruction of archives. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about the where. So, of course, we're dealing with places like Berlin or Jerusalem, or I think I have a really interesting chapter on Cincinnati. What are those archives, and how did those archives as this dream of totality come to be?
So as I mentioned, the three main archives are the Gesamtarchiv in Berlin, the Jewish Historical General Archives in Jerusalem, which today scholars of Jewish history are perhaps more familiar with it by its current name, which is the Central Archives for the History of the Jewish People. They changed their name in the 60s, and then also the American Jewish Archives in Cincinnati. These three archives really stood out to me because they represent three points on a triangle, as it were, between these three different continents, these three different settings. And there's a very close relationship between them as well. This goes back, Stephen, to your question about sort of where this notion of totality is coming from. I identify this kind of beginning in some respects with the Gesamtarchiv, which was
interesting.
In some respects, the first professionalized Jewish archive, quote unquote, in modern Jewish history. It was established in the early 20th century. And Jewish communities had archives. Individuals had archives, of course, throughout history. But really, the Gesamtarchiv is what I would argue is the first effort to do this in a manner that is mirroring the broader professionalization of archival practice, which is actually happening at exactly that same time in Europe in the 1890s and the early 1900s. So the Gesamtarchiv is this effort to gather together the Jewish communal archives, mostly throughout Imperial Germany. And it is the starting point for a whole range of archival projects in other countries, in Austria, in elsewhere as well, where people are looking to the Gesamtarchiv as this prime example of what it means to create a professionally managed Jewish archive according to the most recent best practices of the time. And there's also this kind of broader way in which the Gesamtarchiv kind of stands at the center of this network, just in terms of the people themselves. The Gesamtarchiv was established under the leadership of Eugen Teubler, who was a young German Jewish historian, actually of antiquity. He happened to get the job as the director of the archive, which was dealing with medieval and modern German Jewish history. And so he was the head of this archive, but his assistant Georg Hurlitz would go on to create the Zionist archives, what's now the Central Zionist Archives, first in Berlin, and then he immigrated to Palestine in 1933, and then in British Palestine, later the State of Israel, there's a whole cohort of archivists and scholars who are all kind of connected, like Hurlitz, with the German Jewish intellectual and scholarly sphere, and even with the Gesamtarchiv itself. Josef Meisel, who was the longtime director of the Jewish Historical General Archives when it was established in 1939 until the late 50s. He had been the director of the Jewish Library in Berlin, so basically down the hall from the Gesamtarchiv. Hurlitz was on the board. So was Alex Bein, who was a German Jewish archivist of a younger generation who had worked in the German state archives in Germany prior to the rise of Nazism. So there's this whole cohort of German Jews in America as well. It's just really unbelievable, actually, how this all works out. You have the American Jewish Archives, which is in Cincinnati, and which is established by Jacob Rader Marcus, who is himself an American Jew, but he studies in Berlin in the 1920s for his PhD, and he is close friends with Teubler and with his successor, Teubler's successor, Jakob Jakobson, who takes over the Gesamtarchiv in the 20s, and he also is actually in a class with Alex Bein, who later on, Bein becomes Israel's first state archivist in the 1950s. So you've got these kind of two figures in different poles, right? Of the post-Holocaust Jewish world, right? One in Israel and one in the United States, who have this deep connection with each other and who are both working to help create archives. And so you see this personal connection between all this network of archives. But it's also a connection of ideas. Again, this goes back to where I started, I think, of talking about where the idea of totality kind of relates to all of this. In some respects, I think that all archives want to collect everything, right? Everybody says they have a collecting policy.
Especially in Germany, I'd say.
Yeah. Everybody says that they have a collecting policy. There are limitations, obviously, but I think that the bound up in the entire project of archiving is this vision of at least getting everything in your subject area, right? And I think that in the case of the Gesamtarchiv, this comes out very powerfully. It's bound up both in the name and the vision of the archive and also in their activities. So Teubler spoke on a number of occasions about his dream to gather the collections of all the communities in Germany. And when some of the Jewish communities refused to send their historical materials to Berlin for various reasons that we can talk about, he and his colleagues got very upset about it. And so there's this sort of way in which there's this idea of totality built into the Gesamtarchiv. I would even argue that the name Gesamtarchiv is probably best translated into English as a total archive, in the same way that we talk about Gesamtkunstwerk as a total work of art. So there's a lot going on there. To emphasize this, I think that what you see is this vision of totality is expanded in the post-Holocaust era, where you see these archives in Jerusalem and in Cincinnati both having these expansive archival visions, which are representative of their own cultural context, but also the magnification, you know, of the earlier idea, which they kind of carried with them.
Jason, I wanted to pick up on one of your earlier ideas about the professionalization of archives and archival practices. Could you say a few words, perhaps, about how you see this reflected in certain cases or among certain names of people in Germany or elsewhere?
Yeah. So I think that this question of professionalization and what it means to create a kind of quote unquote professional archive is actually deeply bound up with all of these instances in the sense that, first of all, I think that there is a deeply important relationship between the significance of what it means to create a professional archive and the practical reality of what it means to collect things in the first place. So the Gesamtarchiv, for instance, was established just around the time of the emergence of some of the first professional archival associations in the Netherlands and elsewhere, and they very closely wanted to follow some of these best practices. That are codified at the time in what's known as the Dutch Manual, which is a archival manual produced in 1898 by a group of Dutch archivists, hence the name. But it wasn't just that they read the manual and wanted to do what it said. It's that they made a contrast, right? They tried to contrast what they were doing in gathering these things to a quote-unquote professional historical archive in capital letters between what local communities were doing, who they believed were, in some respect, not preserving historical materials in the way that they should be. So there's this fundamental discord, right, on a basic level, where you have these scholars, who are trying to be professional archivists, who are saying, look, you people, off in communities in Eastern Germany or anywhere else, you don't know how to care for your historical materials. If you hold on to them, they will fall apart. No one will be able to look at them, and so on and so forth. Send them to our central archive, and this plays out more or less everywhere else, right? There's this way in which you have these scholarly figures, some of whom are trained as archivists, some of whom are not, who are all kind of claiming that their status as professionals makes them uniquely suited to hold and to have these historical materials. So you look, for instance, at Alex Bein, who I mentioned briefly before. He becomes Israel's first state archivist in 1956. And he draws heavily on this German archival background. He worked at the Reichsarchiv, which was actually a military archive in Potsdam, starting in 1927. And he actually, his story is very interesting. He trained as a historian. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on Alexander Hamilton, but he couldn't get a job. And he ends up working at this archive. And he really uses this experience at the Prussian archive to bolster his status as a professional archivist. So when he comes to Palestine in 1933, he's fleeing the rise of the Nazi regime. He gets fired from his job, because of the Nazis. And he comes to Palestine where he also can't get a job. He basically is arguing for the professionalization of archival practice in British Palestine, later on the State of Israel. And so there's this element here where he's arguing that by bringing this kind of continental European professional archival tradition to the modern State of Israel, he can help to build the State of Israel. He can help to preserve the Jewish past. And I mean, there's much more I could say about it, but I'll say that there's a parallel in the figure of Ernst Posner, who is also a German archival figure who comes to the United States, I want to say in 1940. He's also fleeing from the Nazi regime. He ends up establishing the archival program at American University, which essentially helps train the an entire generation of American archivists. So there's this whole sort of process of exporting the sort of German archival model, both the United States and, in this case, the State of Israel. And in the case of the State of Israel, the fact that Bein is there and he's saying, look, we are these professional archivists, and so on and so forth. It's not just this question of status in terms of like, okay, do you have a degree or do you not? Or do you have professional archival experience or do you not? In some respects, it doesn't really matter. But I think that it ends up having the significance when you look at the restitution issues, where Bein is able to travel back to Germany in the early 1950s, and he is talking to German politicians, German archivists, and so on and so forth. Some of these are people who he knew before the war and who he worked with.
Exactly.
And he is able to say, like, look, we have in Israel these professional Jewish archives, which I happen to be in charge of, and we can care for these materials in a way that nobody else can. Now, of course, there are Jewish archives in America and elsewhere, but Bein is very condescending towards Jewish archival activities in the diaspora, where he basically is arguing that only in Israel is there this professional archival ethos where we can care for and preserve the Jewish past. And there's a whole dynamic there about the relationship between Israel and the diaspora. But my point here is that when you look at this question of professionalization and what does it mean to create a professional archive, it is bound up with this question of authority and this issue of status of saying who has the right to preserve the Jewish past. And there's much more to go into there, but I think that,
Yeah, I think that's a great answer, Jason. And I'm thinking about YIVO as well, and you know, the digitization that's ongoing, or maybe even that's been completed at YIVO, and some of the other points that you make. I mean, you cover Salo Baron and his, you know, sort of project of Jewish cultural reconstruction as well. Could you say a bit more about the American context? We've covered a lot about the German Jewish context and sort of this professional training in the continental tradition. But one of your mid chapters is actually, I think, in some ways more diasporic, if I can put a word in your mouth. It has to do more with the nation than the state. So what is Jerusalem on the Ohio? Is this another example of the ingathering of the exiles, or is this something else that happened in gathering materials?
Yeah. So let me preface that just with another quick comment about the archives in Jerusalem, because I think that these two archives are deeply connected. I make this parallel in terms of the time, right, that they both are essentially opening in the late 40s, almost exactly the same time. But the ideas are very similar, but at the same time, they are in contrast, a very deep contrast with each other. You mentioned the term of the ingathering of the exiles. Just to
tell us what it is.
Just to reference what that is, because it's also central to this question of the archives in Cincinnati. So Bein and the other archival leaders in Jerusalem, they're working to bring archives to Jerusalem that have been stolen by the Nazis, for the most part, at least in this initial stage. And they are doing it through restitution channels, because this is looted property. And the way that they framed their project is what they called the ingathering of the exiles of the past. So this is a very specific reference to the ongoing project in the early 1950s and beyond of the newly established state of Israel, encouraging the mass migration of Jews from all over the world to the newly established Jewish state, in which they call the ingathering of the exiles, which is a reference to the Jewish liturgy. So the archivists kind of played on this, and they said, you know, we're not just ingathering the exiles of the Jewish people, but we're also in gathering the exiles of the past. That's kind of part of the context of what's taking place for the Jerusalem archives. Now, for the Cincinnati archives, it's a similar context of the post-Holocaust era, but it also has a whole different range of issues, where in some respects, Jacob Rader Marcus, who's the founder of the American Jewish Archives and who runs it for almost 50 years, you know, has a very different perspective, as you said, kind of a diasporic perspective.
Yeah.
And so I think to understand this, to explain this, you know, I'll say just a quick word about Marcus and his historical perspective. Marcus, I'll just say, was not an archivist, and he never really saw himself as one. He wanted to create kind of a historian's archive. He wanted to create a research institution that was not just about preserving the past, but was about serving historians. He was trying to build up the field of American Jewish history, and he wanted to have the tools at his disposal. Literally outside of his front door. So Marcus is kind of an interesting character. He's an interesting fellow. He is, as I mentioned, he's an American Jew. He was born outside of Pittsburgh, and he, at a young age, moves to Cincinnati, actually at the age of 15, to begin training as a Reform rabbi. At the time, if you wanted to be a Reform rabbi at Hebrew Union College, which today it still exists, it was established in 1875 in Cincinnati, and today they also have campuses in New York and in LA and in Jerusalem as well. And it's really the central rabbinical seminary for the Reform movement in Judaism. And so at the time, if you wanted to become a rabbi, you went essentially in high school, and you studied in high school and also in college, right, at the University of Cincinnati at the same time that you did your rabbinical training. So it was like a total of 9 years. And Marcus, he ends up staying in Cincinnati afterwards, after he finishes to teach at the college. And so Marcus is a lifer, so to speak. You know, he moves to Cincinnati in 1911 at the age of 15, and he's there until he dies in 1995. He's kind of this unbelievably interesting character in and of himself. He studies medieval Jewish history initially, but in the course of the years of the Holocaust, he shifts his perspective entirely, and he ends up moving towards the study of American Jewish history. And this is where his archive project emerges from. He starts collecting stuff in the 30s and into the 40s. By the time he gets to 1947 and he establishes his archive, Marcus's archive is a manifestation of his entire cultural and political reorientation as it came to the Jewish past and the Jewish future. He shifted from studying European Jewish history to American Jewish history because he believed very strongly that with the events of the Holocaust, that European Jewry was a closed book of history. And that he should study what was essentially going to be the future, that is American Jewish history. Mm-hmm. And so for him, this idea of studying American Jewish history and gathering historical materials was deeply imbued with this idea that American Jewry was going to become the most significant and important Jewish center in the post-Holocaust era. And so for him, there's this idea, he's not that interested in Israel. You know, in later decades, he kind of changes his orientation and becomes a little bit more Zionist, but he still has these apprehensions that perhaps Israel won't survive. You know, why would you put all of these, these priceless historical materials in a place that's literally under siege? And he is more of a believer in the diaspora as an idea in general. And this manifests itself in his archival project itself, which is to say that the Israeli archivists, people like Alex Bein, Bein's colleague Daniel Cohen, who takes over the Jewish Historical General Archives in the 50s, and all of their colleagues, they're all going on and on about the ingathering of the exiles. And Marcus is saying, no, it's better to have these things dispersed. And the term that Marcus used is kind of this strange term. He called it omniterritoriality. This notion that Jews survived throughout history because they were everywhere, right? And this dispersion of the Jews was the secret to Jewish survival, right? This was his point of view. And so in the same way, he believed that archives should kind of be dispersed. So on the one hand, he is gathering things, obviously, right? But he has this notion as well of the power of dispersion as a force in Jewish history. And also in the Cold War context, there's a whole story here as well, where he is suggesting that centralizing things perhaps is a recipe for disaster. He's talking about in the case of Israel, but also like what's going to happen. He is working in the 50s. What's going to happen if there's a nuclear exchange with the Soviets? So for him, gathering things to Cincinnati is a representation of a whole range of issues for him relating to the Cold War, relating to his understanding of Jewish history, and also about the possibilities of the Jewish future. And there's a great deal more, which I can speak about as well, that's going on here about Marcus's sort of sense of Cincinnati as a historic center of American Jewish life, which in some respects seems kind of strange.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. Lustig.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Yeah, not New York.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's this idea of dispersion, right? Jews kind of being everywhere as opposed to in the place where there happens to be the most Jews.
I wonder if that's also a sort of like point of continuity from not just European continental archive practices, but also from Zionist history. Because, I mean, you're covering in your book so many locations. I was just kind of like trying to trace the geographies of a lot of these central figures in building archives. Where did they go? Where did their expeditions take them? And I guess that it leads me into the next question. You have an entire chapter about post-war Germany and Jewish archives and where Jewish archives should go, if not Berlin. So, you know, I mean, my question would be, how is that earlier local history or maybe municipal history that you cover so well changed after 1945 or 1948 or 1949 in post-war Germany? I mean, I'm starting to, you know, recall places where, in addition to restitution, there are Jewish communities that are revived, like in Hamburg or other places where they're not so revived. So what does it actually mean in let's say, post-war Germany, Koblenz, Berlin, Hamburg, Frankfurt, those sorts of places from the 40s onward?
Yeah, so obviously everything is changing as a result of the Holocaust. When you look at the creation of archives in places like in Jerusalem or in Cincinnati, that this is a representation of a sense among Jews around the world that European Jewry, you know, fairly obviously had been decimated, right? And that there was perhaps no future. And that was in some respects a consensus at the time. There were, of course, many people you know, who felt otherwise and who helped to reestablish Jewish communities. And today, you know, you can see a very vibrant, if of course much smaller, Jewish community in Germany, also in other countries around Europe. But at the time, of course, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, there's this big question, which is what is the future of Jewish life in Germany and in Europe as a whole? And so part of what I'm engaging with in terms of the question of the archives is that the historical materials, it's not just that these are research materials that people can use to write books or articles or whatever, but that they are symbols of this question of what is the future of Jewish life after the Holocaust. And so when you look, you mentioned Hamburg, for instance, and the other key example that I write about in the book is in Worms, you know, which is a very important historic community, one of the oldest Jewish communities in Central Europe. So these Jewish communities, you know, the case of Hamburg and Worms are interesting because, again, if you go back to the Gesamtarchiv at the beginning of the story, these two communities were among those that were hesitant to send their materials to Berlin because they had this very strong sense of self-identity as their own community and of their own history. And they were like, why should we send these things to Berlin? Right? We should keep them for ourselves. So there's always this kind of like local contentiousness over these archives. And this manifests itself after the war. So in the course of the war, the rise of the Nazi regime in the Second World War, the Nazis somewhat notoriously were these big looters. They looted archives and libraries and museums all over Europe, and particularly Jewish ones. You know, this often, you know, gets a lot of attention in terms of the artwork. There are a lot of movies and, you know, books and so on that deal with those particular dramatic stories. And here I'm focusing on the archives, which don't always get as much attention. And so the story of these archives is that they are stolen or otherwise looted in the course of the Nazi regime. And so after the war, there's this whole restitution framework which is set up for the return of stolen Jewish property at large. And so archives kind of fit into that story. And so what's going on here, though, is with the archives, it's like, so who should get them, right? And where should they go? What is the relationship between Jewish communities that are existing in post-war Germany and their past? And so I'll just say a quick word about Worms and Hamburg, just to illustrate this. So Worms is one of the oldest Jewish communities in Central Europe, stretching back over 1,000 years. And so they have all sorts of things. It's really a rich archive. Worms is also where you have one of the, a number of the great medieval exegetes, the great medieval commentators on the Jewish tradition, who are living like the figure of Rashi, for instance. So this is really a storied Jewish community. And after World War II, you have all of this stuff which was there. And it's this question of where should it go? And there really aren't very many Jews who are left in Worms after the Holocaust. And you have this very interesting figure by the name of Friedrich Illert, who is the municipal archivist and kind of the head of all the cultural activities in the city of Worms, who he was never exactly a Nazi. He never joined the Nazi party, even though he kind of worked with the Nazis because he was somewhat of an opportunist, but he never joined the party. And after the war, he, of course, like emphasized this heavily, right? Again, somewhat of an opportunist. He wanted to sort of position himself as a non-Nazi. But anyway, like in the course of the war, what ends up happening is that he actually steals these archives from the Gestapo.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. Yeah.
Right. So in the aftermath. Yeah, in the aftermath of Kristallnacht, these archives are confiscated by the Gestapo, and Illert finds out where they are, and he goes and he steals them from the Gestapo, and he hides them in the municipal archives of Worms for the duration of the war. So this is archives and other kinds of antiquities, other kinds of historical objects and manuscripts. So after the war, Illert sort of is a deep believer that Jews will return to Worms, and he says these things should remain in Worms until Jews will return. And so this goes back and forth for many years, and eventually it ends up getting sent to Israel. And the key issue here is that Jews don't come back to Worms, at least, not in any kind of numbers. There's like one guy who's there who is a, this German Jew who returns to Worms, and he kind of like stands up for Illert, and, there's this whole kind of shouting match, actually. It's kind of amazing. You look at the minutes of these meetings, and Alex Bein is there. They're meeting in Bonn, with German political figures and Illert and the lawyers and all these things. They're debating the fate of these archives. And this German Jewish figure by the name of Eric Meyer, he sort of says, I'm a Worms Jew. I fled from the city. I returned. Other Jews will come back, and these archives should stay here. And Bein kind of stands up. This literally in the notes is an amazing story. He finds stands up and he screams in his face, how can you how can you live with yourself? Right. Yeah. How can you, claim yourself as a Jew, essentially, right? By returning to the scene of the crime, as it were, of the Holocaust. And so what you see here is this kind of debate about, is there a future of Jewish life in Germany? And the materials end up going to Israel in large part because Jewish life does not rematerialize in Worms. In Hamburg, it's a different story, right? So in Hamburg, you have this deeply independent Jewish community, which is representative of Hamburg itself, being a city-state, right? It has this long history of independence. And the Jews in Hamburg, in the early 20th century, don't want to send their things to Berlin. And in the 1930s, the Hamburg Jews actually put their own archives in the state archives of Hamburg, in part so that the stuff doesn't go to Berlin. So after the war, it's like, okay, so what happens to all of these archival materials? And the difference between Hamburg and Worms is that there is a significant Jewish community in Hamburg in the aftermath of the Second World War. It's one of the larger Jewish communities in post-war Germany. And so there are Jews who are there. And it's also unclear if these were actually quote-unquote looted materials because they weren't confiscated by Nazi authorities. They were, at least theoretically, given by the Jews to the state archives. But then, of course, the debate is, can you give something willingly, right, in this coercive context of the Nazi regime?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
So this all comes out in these court battles in the 1950s over what does it mean for it to be looted property and so on and so forth. But the central issue here, again, is about what is the future of Jewish life in Germany? These archives are purportedly about the past, but they are actually standing in for this question of, does Jewish life in Germany have a future? And what is the connection between post-war German Jewish life and what came before it? So essentially, by extracting these archives and bringing them in, again, to Jerusalem, to what's now the Central Archives for the History of the Jewish People, what you see is this process of essentially arguing that whatever kind of Jewish life existed in Germany after World War II essentially didn't have any connection with its past because these symbols of its past were being removed. there's this whole sort of element of foreclosing on that possibility of connecting with the past. And there are many elements here where a significant portion of the Jews living in Hamburg, right, I'm calling them German Jews, but for many Jews, among them former German Jews, these were not quote unquote German Jews, because you have Jewish displaced persons who had been sort of like, again, you know, forcibly moved into Germany by the Nazis towards the end of World War II as part of the death marches, you know, so on and so forth, for instance, to, you know, concentration camps like Bergen-Belsen, which is not that far from Hamburg. And so what you end up with is this very, you end up with this very large Eastern European Jewish population that is in post-war Germany, right, as displaced persons, and then some of them who settle in Germany in the aftermath of the war. And so you have a lot of, you know, in this case, we're talking about Israeli archivists, right, who many of them were German Jews, you know, that's where they came from, who are saying, look, these people who are living in Hamburg, they're not even German Jews, right? You know, they're Eastern European Jews, right? What is the connection between this new Jewish community and the old one? You know, this manifests itself in very personal terms. I've talked a lot about Alex Bein, you know, who was himself from Southern Germany. But another major figure is Daniel Cohen, another younger German Jewish figure. He was born in 1935. He flees to Palestine, you know, with his family as a child, and he becomes a leading archivist in Israel. He runs the Jewish Historical General Archives from the 50s through the 80s. He's from Hamburg, right? So here you have like Alex Bein and Daniel Cohen, who are traveling to Hamburg in the 50s and saying like, look, you know, we're German Jews, right? Send this stuff to Israel. And Cohen is able to kind of like play on his and use his own status as a Jew from Hamburg, right, to say like, you know, these things should go to Jerusalem. And there's this whole, again, this whole fight is, you know, it's not just a custody battle, right? It's not about who's going to get it, but it's about what it's going to represent. That ultimately, you know, whoever holds these materials is making a claim. They're staking a claim on this idea that they have an ability to kind of like shape the future. And that's really where, I mean, we haven't talked about this a whole lot yet, but I talk about archives and the control of Jewish culture. There's a whole theoretical side to that, which we can get into if we want. But I think that ultimately, when you look at all of these examples in Germany, before and after World War II, in Jerusalem and in Cincinnati, there's a lot going on here in terms of the specific histories of the specific archives. But what's really at stake here is about who gets to have control over this material, and thereby, in very symbolic and also in some cases in very practical terms, they should have control over Jewish life itself, especially in the aftermath of the Holocaust.
Right. I wanted to move, actually, Jason, I think this is a good segue into some of your big philosophical points about, again, totality, nationalization, professionalization, modernity. I'm thinking about in your conclusion when you're writing about what Pierre Nora said about memory and laying claim to memory and memory becoming archival and memory in a sense becoming archival as a way to do history through documents and going to archives and looking at these documents, whether they're institutionalized in a centralized manner or not. But I wonder if you could talk about these continuities that you see between the analog universe and the digital universe. I think this is a great contribution in your book. What is it in the 21st century that makes an archive? And what is an archive, I guess, is the most basic question. But, you know, since you're emphasizing so much of this in continuity from the 20th century, where do you see the digitization projects leaning on these former legacies? Are there specific instances or visions or philosophies that you see as still present?
Yeah, thank you for bringing up the question of the digital. I think that one of the questions that we can ask about, say, for instance, the restitution battles of the 1950s, is like, okay, so now that we can digitize things, you know, why does it matter who has the originals? I guess to some extent that perhaps, you know, digitization does make some of those issues kind of a moot point. I would argue that that's actually not the case. I think that part of what we see with the rise of digitization technologies is a couple of things. The first one, and this is, I think, a really central point, they are not necessarily a huge break with the past, right? So one thing I didn't say about Jacob Rader Marcus and his vision of a kind of an archive of diaspora, right? This is both an archive of the diaspora, but it's an archive of dispersed materials. He is very interested, this is in the late 40s, early 50s, in microfilm, right? And he basically is like running around.
Yeah. He's obsessed with it.
He's running around basically the entire Western Hemisphere. He's not just talking about the United States. He's looking at North America, but also Central America and South America, where you have some of the earliest Jewish communities in the Western Hemisphere, dating back to the early colonial period. So Marcus is running around, and even when people won't give him things in the original, he's like, okay, no big deal, I'll take a photo. And in some respects, this is very contemporary, right? We think about how historians go about doing their research today. Now, of course, there are many archives that won't let you make photocopies, won't let you take photos for various reasons. But, here you have Marcus in the early 50s actually complaining about YIVO, right? One of the premier institutions of studying Eastern European Jewish history, saying like, why won't you let us take photocopies, right? That's kind of like medieval, right? That's kind of the way he talks about it, right? How can you be in the 20th century and not let people take photocopies? And so what you have here is this early, I think you used the word obsession, with microfilm. And so what you see here is that digitization is an improvement on microfilm in many ways, right? But I think that we can see that people were already interested in talking about duplicates, even before the rise of digitization technology. So that's one part of it. But the thing that I think is really important for us to understand, it's not just that there's a continuity, but there is a magnification of the possibilities of what existed before with the rise of digitization. So like to illustrate this, with a digitization project that never actually happened. So in the mid 80s, there is an effort to create a kind of a new archive of German Jewry. This leads eventually to the formation of what's now in Heidelberg, the Zentralarchiv zur Forschung der Geschichte der Juden in Deutschland, the central archive for the study of the history of Jews in Germany. So this project begins a few years earlier. This is in 1987, and then in 84 and 85, there's this proposal from the German government to provide resources for the creation of a new German Jewish archive. And you have a figure of Fred Grubel, who's the executive director of the Leo Beck Institute in New York at the time, who's like, why create a new archive in Germany, right? Why, all of these archival materials relating to German Jewry are scattered, in places like Jerusalem, in New York, in Cincinnati, in London, in all these different places where you have archival materials. Why create a new archive when you can digitize everything, right? This is year 85. Mm-hmm. He's saying, you can take digital copies of things and create this central repository, which then can be accessed in different places. And it's kind of an amazing proposal, because this is prior to the rise of the internet and all these different things, and nothing really comes of it. The Germans are not really interested in it, and perhaps that proposal was kind of before its time, just technologically speaking. But what you have here is this indication, this very early indication, that digitization actually magnifies the possibility of totality, right? I talked about the ways in which like the archivists in Germany and elsewhere have this idea of collecting everything, right? In Jerusalem, it's magnified because now they're talking about not just Jewish materials in Germany, but from all over the world, right? What becomes known as the central archives for the history of the Jewish people as a whole. And yet in both of these projects, it's impossible. It remains so. But when you talk about digitization, perhaps it sidesteps some of these questions of ownership, but it means that now it's possible to have an archive of everything. And we see this, like we talk about, kind of moving away from Jewish history for a moment. You look at Google, any number of these archive projects, like the Internet Archive, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, genealogy projects.
right. Like Ancestry.com, right? This tree of everybody. Well, of course, it's impossible, but digital technology invites this fantasy of limitless possibilities, right? At least it seems to no longer be limited by physical space. Though, of course, anybody who looks seriously and thinks deeply about digital technology understands that it is physical, right? We talk about the cloud, this ephemeral thing, but it's actually a bunch of physical servers, running on electricity somewhere, right? So anyway, come back to the question of digitization and Jewish archives, I think that what we see in terms of digitization projects is a magnification of the fantasy that you can have everything, because all of a sudden you kind of can, you know, or at least it might be possible because you can take a digital copy. This is something that we've seen in terms of like what Evo has been doing, and they actually just quote unquote completed the project in January of 2022. I'm saying quote unquote because these things are never complete, and I'm sure that they will eventually find more materials to digitize. But for the past 7 years or more, they have been digitizing historical materials that Evo had kind of found out about that were in Lithuania. Evo was established, you know, as the Yiddish Scientific Institute in Vilnius, in Vilna, in 1924-25. And today, you know, the main center of Evo is in New York. It relocates during World War II. And they end up, again, through restitution, getting a whole bunch of their materials that had been stolen by the Nazis. But a lot of it remained in Lithuania after World War II. And right. So towards the end of the Cold War, they kind of find out that there is all this material in various libraries and archives in Lithuania that had once been part of Evo in some way. And actually part of the interesting part of the story is that not all of it had been part of Evo. I could say more about that in a second. But essentially, Evo tried to get the originals, was not able to do that. And then in the early 2010s, under Jonathan Brent, you know, he initiated this project supported by the NEH, you know, by the National Endowment for the Humanities, to digitize the materials that were in Lithuania and to reconstitute the archive of YIVO as it had been before the war, quote unquote. Part of what's interesting about this is that in reality, and I mean, the people at YIVO are probably going to hear this and say, he's got it wrong, but I mean, this is my take on it, right? And this is what I talk about in the book. Ultimately, they are creating a new collection, right? You know, the idea of virtual collections, of virtually reunifying dispersed collections, is something that digital technologies allow us to do. But part of what is important for us to understand is that digital technologies make it seem like we are reunifying things, but in reality, we are creating something new. Right. And yeah. I think that this is kind of central to my point about archives as a whole, which is that in this kind of time together, quote unquote, of modern Jewish culture, people are gathering together the dispersed remnants of the Jewish past. And it seems like they are reconstituting something that it used to be. But in reality, it's always a process of creation, creating something new. And the other example of this is the Cairo Geniza, you know, where the story of the Cairo Geniza, whether or not it's an archive is a story for another podcast. But it's this collection of historical materials that was in Cairo to the late 19th century. Then figures like Salman Schechter and other scholars brought much of it to the UK. You know, there's this whole Orientalist angle to that, right? And what does it mean to literally, as they put it, bring the booty of the Egyptians back to Oxford and Cambridge, right? But anyway, so the story of the Cairo Geniza is it really is one of the most significant repositories of materials on medieval Jewish life in the Middle East, North Africa, the world of the Indian Ocean, and beyond. It's really an amazing resource that, that people have been mining now for many decades and doing tremendous research, but it's scattered all over the place, right? And so in the 90s and in the early 2000s, there's this idea to kind of to bring it back together. And this is a project which is still ongoing, the Friedberg Geniza project, which again is this kind of amazing resource, this idea.
Another digitization project, right?
Exactly, right. So the Friedberg project initially wanted to create a union catalog of the different Geniza fragments. So you could like kind of like have a list of like what's in the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York and what's at, you know, Dropsy College now at the University of Pennsylvania, what is at Cambridge, et cetera, right? But eventually, once the technology matures, in about 2005 or so, an Israeli computer scientist by the name of Yaakov Shweka comes on board and he helps to develop a project to digitize everything. And the idea is then to make everything available online. And in addition, to kind of reconnect different fragments. So you might have a document, right? Let's say that you have a letter, right, that was written, say, in the year 1100, right? And so this manuscript, this letter, at some point got broken in half, sitting in the Geniza, which is really just a storeroom. And in the process of these things making their way to various Western universities and other kinds of institutions, half of it ended up in Cambridge and half of it ended up in New York. So in order to study this letter, you need to literally go to both places and piece together the puzzle. And so the Friedberg project has done this kind of really amazing thing where they're using computer vision technologies to identify ways to rejoin these things back together. And this whole kind of metaphor as a whole for reconnecting the Cairo Geniza and recreating supposedly what was in Cairo, you know, prior to when Salman Schechter and other Western scholars showed up and took it away. And in here, I'll kind of plug also another forthcoming book by Rebecca Jefferson, which is titled The Cairo Geniza and the Age of Discovery in Egypt, who deals with some of these issues of the multiple and complex provenances of the Cairo Geniza. So like part of what I'm arguing here in my book is that you look at the Friedberg Project and you look at the like this effort to recreate the Cairo Geniza, well, you can't put the pieces back together again. It's actually creating something new. And this is partially because they actually include things that were never part of the Cairo Geniza beforehand. So part of what is going on here, when you look at the history of these archives, ranging from the Gesamtarchiv to the reconstruction of the Cairo Geniza, is that everybody is talking about bringing back together the fragments of Jewish life. But it's not actually possible to do that. You're always in the process of creating something new. What that represents and what that means is that the gathering of archives, this kind of shared impulse to do all of these things, is fundamentally contentious because it is never just about the past. It's always about what the future might hold. That is really like what's central to this book as a whole. And we see archives as not just being these neutral repositories where we put things and the scholars go and they sit in these dusty reading rooms. But in actuality, all of these projects, just like the study of history as a whole, is deeply imbued with this question of who gets to control history, who gets to tell the story, who gets to have access to it. You look at these digitization projects, right? It seems like it's making everything accessible. And to some degree, it is, especially in our current COVID age. Like, it's not so easy to travel to archives. Something like the Friedberg Project or Leo Beck's initiative to digitize their materials and, you know, Evo's as well, certainly makes it easier to do research, you know, when we can't really travel so much. But it's not simply democratizing history. It's also another way of controlling the past, right? Because you still have kind of a central point of failure, right? Of like, what happens if their servers go down, right?
You know, that's a great point.
And so on and so forth. Now, of course, you would think that they, and I would hope that they have backups. But my point is that digitization kind of masks these earlier issues, which are still there, right? It still matters who holds these materials, who gets to say that it's under their banner, right? It's literally on their website, right? And so on and so forth. And I think when we talk about what it means to have archives and the control of Jewish culture, is that ultimately the process of gathering archives is a question of control. It's a question of ownership. But in the end, you know, part of the big question is, can anybody really own history? I'm not really sure anybody really can.
Well, I think, Jason, that's a really great place to end in thinking about how we began in Cairo, or how you began in your book, and the multiple historical societies and communities for Jewish life that pre-existed, not only the State of Israel or the Holocaust, but also state archives when they began to be formed, or professional historical organizations at the end of the 19th century. It's a really great way of thinking about decentralization and who owns the past. So I want to thank you for joining me in conversation here to talk about your new book. We've been speaking with Jason Lustig, historian at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is called A Time to Gather, Archives and the Control of Jewish Culture, just out, published by Oxford University Press in 2021. Thanks again, Jason, for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. This was really a pleasure.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here at New Books Network. Until next time.